No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Hunting in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, Michael D. Brown, the former United States Senator from the District of Columbia, and I'm joined by my co-host, Liberty Jones. And tonight we have a special guest. We have with us Admiral Joe Sestak. We're so happy to have you with us, Admiral. Admiral Sestak was a former Democratic candidate for President of the United States. He was also an admiral in the United States Navy for 31 years, had a distinguished career, and is the highest ranking member of the military ever elected to Congress. And he was a congressman from Pennsylvania. We're so happy to have him with us today. We have so many things to ask him about. Thanks so much, Admiral Sestak, for being back on the show. The last time you were here was about 18 months ago, and a lot has happened since then. So thanks for being with us.
Senator, thank you. It's great to be aboard with you again. And a lot really has been happening, particularly recently.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Let's start by talking about the 800-pound gorilla in the room, okay? And then we'll have my co-host, Liberty, join us. But they fired the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, okay? And they're going to replace this guy with somebody, a retired lieutenant general, who they're calling Dan Raisin Kane. What a name. And they've gotten rid of the Navy's top person, Admiral Franchetti, and several other top officials. Now, am I wrong here, Admiral? I'm not a military man, but it's my understanding of battle tactics that the first thing you go after is the command structure. So are we making a big mistake here by dismantling our command structure?
We certainly are, without a question, not only making a big mistake, but we are harming one of the most sacred things that we have in the United States military. And that is the moment a service member takes the oath of office. Because from that moment on, Senator, they know that that oath demands that their personal beliefs will now be subordinate to the professional obligations. I can give you the best example I can of what this means. Back when I was in Congress, General Hamm, 4-star Army general, was tasked to see if we should do away with don't ask, don't tell, and let those who were gay serve openly in the military. And the question was, as many allege, much like today, when they talk about DEI programs and other things, it would harm our readiness in the military. When he stuck this, the 6-month study came before Congress and concluded that it would not, letting gays serve openly, harm the readiness of the military. I, as a junior congressman, was one of the last to ask him a question. I asked him only one, because I already knew it wouldn't harm it, because if you were a good commanding officer, you knew who were gay, or you just didn't know your crew.
Yeah.
And when one would come up to me as the captain of a ship and say, Captain Hamm, begin to tell me, I said, please, I thought, don't tell me, you're too good, I don't want to lose you. So I asked him, General, tell me, if you would, what is your personal belief of gays serving in the military? He looked at me for a moment, and then he said, I haven't been asked that before. Because of my religious beliefs, I do not condone it personally. But I was not asked that question as a military man. I was asked to assess if such a repeal would harm our readiness, and it would not. You could not have had a greater imprimatur of what taking that oath of office means, supposed to mean, to our nation, we take it to our Constitution by every American service member. And that means that that general showed that professional conduct expected over his personal belief. That is what he's harming, to where we could have people beginning as they're crafting their career, so to speak, in the military. Do I kind of say this, even though I maybe don't believe in it? Do I give my honest opinion on something? And let me tell you, if there's the biggest deficit in America today, not the debt, it isn't. It's the trust deficit. And to have someone that you ask a question where you can begin to wonder if you can trust it, because we've now politicized that command structure where it's trust that you will make the honest, candid statement as professionally, not personally, is what's being harmed.
Yeah, and I got to just say, from my personal experience with military people, I spend a lot of time over the years with military people, come from a military family, that's so true, Admiral. There are different military people are a different breed of people. They're very honorable and very noble, and they're very stand up. And they believe in what they do, and that's so important. I mean, and thanks so much for saying that, because I don't know that a lot of people realize that, but if we lose our faith in the people that are running things, oh my God. Liberty, you're with us now. You're brilliant and young, so why don't you ask the Admiral a question? What do you think of all this stuff?
Hi. So I'm happy I was able to make it. I had some issues, but thank you so much for joining us, Admiral Sestak.
Joe, please. Thanks for being with me.
I heard you talk about the don't ask, don't tell policy, and about how it was a significant issue during your time in the military, and thank you again for your service. So what was your stance on this policy when it was in place? And how do you think that it impacted the morale and the readiness within the Navy itself, since you were there to witness it firsthand?
Don't ask, don't tell the policy that after it passed, I was a brand new admiral in the Pentagon. And the boss I worked for was a 2-star admiral. And he asked me, what do you think about it? And I was honest with him. I said, sir, I think it's unconstitutional. But we're going to have to execute it because it is the law. And we went about it. And as I said, I hated it when someone would come up and start to say, I'm gay, because I would have to let them go. And they were just too good. I bring this up because I joined up in the military back in the mid-70s. And there were race riots and aircraft carriers then. When I got aboard my first ship, on the second day I was aboard it, the African-American on that crew walked off the ship at lunchtime. Not during working hours, during lunchtime in August, and stood at attention in ranks by themselves on the pier next to the ship. They didn't say anything for one hot, very hot August hour. As soon as the toll was spun that, hey, everybody back on board, everybody got back to work, they were right there doing the great job. The captain went down a little concerned and said, what's going on? And he found a number of things, such as, hey, how come are we given disproportionately duties on the long weekends, on the holiday? And he corrected those things. I bring that up because I had to go through similar programs like DEI. They were racial programs. They were programs that had to do with gender coming in. I was there as women. I was first ship that had women on combatant ship. It was training, but it was Christmas time, Persian Gulf, and one ship has to be underway every, no matter where you are on Christmas Day. And I was a junior guy in the Persian Gulf. And we're going to get underway. So I went next door to the non-combatant ship and said, hey, would some of the women like to come aboard, get underway for a couple of days with us? We're going to change eventually. And they did. Ratchet ahead. And I arrived at my aircraft carrier battle crew as we transitioned. And we had these programs. So if you read up, you'll find many of these programs, including DEI now, recently, they have certain uncertainties. They're not all work as well as they should, but they set a tone. When I arrived off that coast of Afghanistan, we were launching in the early days the best pilots we had have been in the first Gulf War. In with them, we would put a nugget. That's someone who hasn't been flying over a foreign country before. She was 26 years old. She went up with 7 pros from Dover, been in the first Gulf War. And there they were that night, and she was the one that disobeyed the orders that I passed down. We told them, nobody goes below 20,000 feet unless you call back, and we have time to move over the countermeasures asset we had, that they could protect you as you went below, because the Mujahideen, now rebranded as Taliban, had Stinger missiles that went up to 18,000 feet. And before you went below, we wanted time to protect you. But 8 special forces were ambushed at about 0200 that. 4 died immediately. The others called up. And they said, we have moments left. Somebody strafe and dive. They're too close to shoot laser-guided munitions. Somebody help quickly. The men asked permission. That young 26-year-old woman pilot thought there wasn't time. She dove 3 times from 20,000 to 3,000 feet, strafing, and in that havoc she created, those men picked up their dead comrades and came home, and they wouldn't have if we hadn't had her there that night. The CNO who they just removed, Lisa Franchetti, was on my staff there. She saw it all happen. But she was also, as we went out with the troops, sailors sometimes, to board contraband ships that were either sneaking in Al-Qaeda and or munitions and or contraband to Iraq. She jumped on that where I didn't know she was. Found out later she had trained with the crew privately. As we scaled the ship, 30 feet tall, vertically on a rope ladder, went up, circled it as an armed helicopter, as we had guns and or looking down to make sure if there was any mischief, they could handle it. And I'm not surprised that that future CNO did become the CNO. She was extremely good. My point of all this is, when it cost $140,000 up to that amount to recruit a person to enlist today, $140,000, I want to make sure we get the best of all demographics, no matter who, what, when, where you are. And that's why we're going to be a better military, but we won't with what's happening today.
Well, we could see the inherent racism and misogyny that's in a lot of these decisions that are being made. I mean, it just seems crazy to me. But let me move on. Obviously, it's a mistake to fire these people at the very top, Admiral. But what about them? They're also getting rid of 5,400 civilian employees. Don't civilian employees play an important role in our national defense?
They're instrumental in it. Why? Because, you know, I go to sea for 3 years. Then I come ashore for 2 or so. Then I go to sea for 3 years, as we all do. Or you go out and to an Air Force station in Korea or somewhere else, or you go to an Army base. And when you're home, you're not home all the time. You're going about half that 2 years at home, whatever, working up again to get ready with a new crew, you know, change of crews. So it's pretty demanding. But those civilians are steady and they're there. They're handling the budget. They're handling the nuclear weapons program. They are handling so much stuff that we need them. Now, could we find savings in the Department of Defense? You bet we could. Let me just give an example. All right. 70% of all the money of defense's budget goes to contractors. Now, back in the end of the Cold War, we used to have about 50 contractors that provided defense equipment, etc. Today, we have 5. They become semi-monopolies, and they do nothing but defense. I mean, back then, General Mills, who made cereal, used to do our guidance program. And because they had to be in the competition in the commercial world also, they tended to be more innovative. So what we have now today with these 5 contractors is they get what's called cost plus contracts. They're not fixed price. So you probably may have heard recently in the last 2-3 weeks, they just came in and said, for the F-35 aircraft that they're building and finishing building, we need another $500 billion, which is 12 times more than USAID's very critical program. They're one of our best allies in preventing wars. $500 billion. I mean, that's one-fourth of Elon Musk's supposedly $2 trillion goal in one program. But think about the impact when that was had to be acquiesced to, because you're locked in with this unanticipated cost. It meant that the F-35 combat training hours had to be reduced more. I say more because its mission-capable rate, that is, battle readiness, was already so low at 52%. When it's supposed to be 90% for the whole force of F-35, that now will probably go down to 45 or 40%. Talk about the lack of lethality. So what we need is maybe Dodge to come in and try to show how did Elon Musk, with SpaceX, be able to throw up in space 2 pounds. For every 2 pounds, it only cost about $1,000. But for NASA to do it, it was about $12,000. Can he tell us how to do contractors? He's one of those contracts. But here's the real secret. We do estimates within the military of how good that first price they give us. Let's take the Virginia submarine. The confidence that they give us, which we do not provide to Congress, although when I was in Congress, I put out a bill that said they should, was only 33%. Would you buy a car? If you know 5 years from now when you got it, you only had 33% confidence that it would be worth, you only had to pay $30,000? No. Now, maybe we have to make it 80% or something like that because, you know, these are pretty exotic weapons, some of them. But those are the kinds of ways that they could come in and help us try to do contracting where 70% of all DOD money go. The personnel, well, I'll tell you, I'm lucky they were there every time it came back with Navy strategy to run, Navy and force development, etc. So no, I think that they're taking a hatchet rather than a scalpel, and they're starting to hit live organs.
Well, let me just ask you: do you think, you know, all I can think of is that my Nietzsche keeps on coming back to me, that out of chaos comes order. Do you think that's what they're trying to do? Are they trying to make it so chaotic that they can reorder everything? Because if order really does come out of chaos, if you're the people that provide the order, then you're the people that control everything. Do you think that's a strategy?
I've heard of that and read of that strategy. But the key is, if it is already ordered, as it is with our civilian system. I mean, there are some issues in the civilian service, okay? It can take up to 141 days to get an appeal that you're being fired, for example. And about 40% of all workers in civil service have reported that they know somebody who should have been dismissed but hasn't been. But that doesn't mean that's more than a few percent. And that's, everybody has that. We have that in the Navy. That's why we have court martials. We are great sailors, right. But sometimes somebody, you know, pick it up. You know, everybody has to pay a tax along the way. No, it's a pretty darn good. Where this order is in the contracting side and one other. And this is where they could shake it up. We have at RAND a couple years ago, last I looked, which runs war games, well, 17 of the 18 war games that we have they played against China. In fact, about 2 years ago, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said that the Chinese ran circles around us in the largest Joint Staff war game of the year. Why? It's as Dave Akhmanek at RAND Corporation said, the brain, the computers, are being disconnected from the nervous system, the network. We are therefore blind, deaf, and dumb. That is, we are extraordinarily poor at the new domain of warfare, cyberspace, and that means cyber offense and defense. The Defense Science Board has said the largest science board brought in from outside to look all year round at how well defense programs all said there isn't one major weapon system in the U.S. military we have compromised, that we have confidence in, hasn't been somewhat compromised. that Bloomberg News report did. That servers that are made for each ship, CIA drone, over there, Apple also, over there in China, had chips in them, much like Soviet Union sleeper agents that can be woken up someday on an Aegis radar system. No one has denied that in the military. Apple denied it that they felt it wasn't so. But the only way to check is to break open and break and destroy the server system. As someone said, even if it isn't true, it can be true. So we have the wrong type of measurement in the military. I would say that's without a step, maybe chaotic. Just like at the end of World War II, we're measuring, or take the Navy that I was part of, our military prowess by counting how many hulls we have. How many ships? When the real question is, can they shoot the weapons? Because if you're blind, deaf, and dumb, you're no better than John Paul Jones. And that is what concerns me when Rand says we've lost 17 of 18 war games because the networks, as the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says, the Chinese cut down our networks immediately. As you well know, as Wall Street Journal reported last summer, the Chinese are inside the system that the FBI uses to listen in on any conversation they want, even this one, over phones. All they have to do is go to FISA and get a warrant. But the Chinese are in there. And as of 2-3 weeks ago, we can't get them out because we don't know how they got in. I take a bunch of less ships in order to make sure cyber-wise were secure. So yes, I do think your theory that you mentioned could apply it, but make sure you don't do it on the world's best downhill skier, as you just know she's just become the highest, I've got her name for a moment, just down the other day, skiing down the slope where it's working. Go where it isn't working and help us with that, Dodge.
Well, I mean, I don't know what to say to that, Admiral, other than it's scary. We have a caller that wants to ask a question. Paul Harrison. Paul, are you with us? Can we get him on?
I am. I'm here. And my
hey, Paul, how are you?
Well, I'm going to say that my controller, which you've met, both of you. Well, I wouldn't say controller, but here's the deal. General, you just mentioned, or Admiral, you just mentioned trust deficit. That is the most definitive, that's the most definitive thing I've heard in weeks. I heard you speak in Boone, Iowa, and the next 2 weeks I hauled your butt and your whole crew around. One thing I'll tell you, if you're going to run for president, you run again. But I can't run with you because you ran every parade we hauled to. Do you remember that?
What was the very end about the parade?
You ran every parade, shook every hand of every person on the on the parade routes.
Yes.
You irritated the shit out of me because it's totally messed up my timeline of getting you from one place to another. But I'm telling you, for anybody listening, this guy ran every four or five parades.
Paul, I appreciate that. And my very best to Tamara. My conversations with you all and with her, she made me a firm adherent to statehood for D.C., although I had co-sponsored a bill for that, I told her, when I was in the Congress. How is she doing?
She's standing 3 feet from me. She can answer.
I'm doing well, Admiral. Thank you.
But that's wonderful to hear. But I have to tell you, I went to a homeless shelter. Yeah, Paul, I don't remember this, Tamara. When I first got out, they didn't have really any volunteers. I stumbled on you all. And I got a couple guys, about 8 guys from a homeless shelter who were veterans, a veterans homeless shelter there in Des Moines. And they used to pass out brochures ahead of me, and I'd walk back and run back and forth and shake their hands and say, that's me right there. Please read it. And I loved it. And that's where I learned about Iowa niceness.
Wow. Yeah,
we're
not
nice
always,
in
Iowa, huh?
Nice.
I mean,
we're not always nice. We try to be effective, but we're also selective. You mentioned something about blind, deaf, and dumb. I absolutely 100% just my foot come off the floor when you said that, because we have a world out there that maybe they're not blind, maybe they're not deaf, maybe they're not dumb, but quick thing. I'm dealing with cancer and my brain ain't working great. And I know you lost a daughter the same, but I want the people to know this. I know that at 6:30 in the morning, we were outside the homeless shelter in Des Moines, and there was a lady that was volunteering to walk in the parade. Tamara, would that have been 4th of July or Memorial?
Yep. It was July 4th, I think. Go ahead.
So, that being said, when you said a trust deficit, there is a trust deficit. I've had the opportunity to work with them, a lot of great people, and spend a lot of time with Colin Powell and a lot of different people in the world. But when you came out to run for president, you ran. We couldn't keep up with you in the parade. And I will tell you, you pissed me off. It was totally screwing up my plan to get people from beginning to end.
But I got to tell you, Paul. I'm sorry. Go ahead, interrupt me.
But fast forward, however many years, I introduced a friend of mine to Michael Brown last week via phone, and the first thing that pops up, the world's the size of a quarter. First thing pops up for Michael, hey, Joe Sestak's on my show this Sunday. And I'm like, okay, I'm jumping in.
We thank you for calling in, Paul. We appreciate your input. And I agree with you 100%, knowing the Admiral a little bit. That he's an amazing guy and an amazing campaigner. And we're going to move on right now to talk about a little bit of politics, because there's a lot going on there. But if you, for our listeners, Paul and his wife Tamara are well known in Iowa to the Democratic Party. They were really the backbone. When I was out there for the Iowa caucuses, the two of them were just, all I had to do was drop Tamara's name and doors opened everywhere because she's so well respected. And also, you know, I would be neglectful if I didn't thank her for being in charge of a group called Iowans for DC Statehood. It really, really helps our cause a lot to have people outside the district who are fighting to get us the rights that we deserve. And I thank you, Admiral, for your support when you were in Congress. And let me tell you, I made a big faux pas when you came on the show, Admiral. I forgot to thank you for your service, which is the first thing you should always do with a military person. So thanks for filling in there, Liberty, and reminding me that that's what we should do. But thanks for calling in, Paul, and best to you and Tamara. Now, can I ask you, Admiral?
Paul, very much. I can't tell you very much. And just remember, I'm not at fault for those parades, because I learned out in there that when somebody has a good bounty of fruit or corn or something, they say, let's have a parade to celebrate. And that's why there were so many. So thank you.
Okay. Well, we're out of time. But, we're blessed to meet people that want to make a difference in the world. That's it. We all take different approaches to that. Our door is always open. Joe, if you don't run again, I'm going to come and haunt you. And I mean that from two levels.
Well, that would be a good reason to run. I think we got to move on, Paul, but God bless you, and we'll keep you in our prayers. I hope your health gets better, and again, we just appreciate everything that you and Tamara have done, and I think that the Admiral feels the same way. But thanks so much for calling in, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks. Admiral, can I ask you now about, I just came from the annual meeting of the Democratic Party, the winter meeting, where they've elected a new chairman. They've elected Ken Martin, who was the chairman of the Minnesota Democratic Party, one of the most liberal parties in the country. I personally think they made a mistake there. I don't think we're getting it as Democrats, Admiral, that America is changing and we need to change with it. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about we've elected yet another white liberal guy to run our party? I think that there were other candidates available, Martin O'Malley, who was governor of Maryland, and some other people that might have been a better choice. But what do you think? You think our party's headed in the wrong direction? Do we need to change? What do we need to do?
I'll know it's headed in the right direction when I see that it recognizes that it has missed out on the most important part over the last, I'd say, 8 years. And that is that they've missed out on the working family. And I mean this. Look, when General Akrameyev, the head of USSR's Soviet Union's head general, came over as the Gorbachev era was happening, Admiral Crowell took him all around America, including to a barbecue in Arkansas, went on aircraft carriers, went to military bases, went to a mall, and after a week, he asked him, what was it that most impressed you about America? And he said, it's your enlisted. Not the officers, it's the enlisted. We don't have them. Yeah. And you could see that when Russia first went into Ukraine, their conscripts were slaughtered. We have working families in our military. They're the enlisted. And they have saved my back at least twice by telling me I was doing something wrong. We have forgotten the working families. When I went to Iowa, I'd go there and there's, I think, approximately 67 or so counties. Only two were growing at the time. The rest were losing populations. The working families there, the farmers, or elsewhere, the coal mines, they were closing down. And I asked a Republican police officer who had been in Newark as a deputy chief commissioner. He went out for his retirement job where he'd been raised, or his wife had been raised, excuse me, in Iowa. And someone said, call him. I did. And I said, well, how's the crime here? As I told Paul, it's Iowa niceness. He said, same rate as I have in Newark. It's just different type of crime. Not the murders, not the robberies and all that. It is the petty theft. It is the domestic abuse. It's the I'm their safety net. They're losing. Their farms are closing. They're being bought off by combines. And elsewhere, it's coal mines. They're getting kicked out. There's people in the working family, like, who gave us, mainly in the rurals, the energy for a century in this nation. The agriculture, even today in this nation, except for the large combines that have closed them down. And they also serve in our military. 42% of our military, it comes from 13 states, most of them in the rurals. And now all of a sudden they're closing? They're 65% of our population. They're the enlisted, the ones who make it happen. And we focus primarily on forgiving college loans. It's just like Pink said, and I said this out in Des Moines, Iowa. It's like Pink's great song is from Bucks County, Pennsylvania, said, what about us? To me, right. I understand all the other aspects, but if you don't take care of those enlisted, if you don't take care of the working family, like making sure that we put less into training and retraining than any developed nation, any OECD nation in the world, we've got to get back to them. Their hospitals are closing out there. To me, that's the biggest thing. We can do all the other stuff, but how can they trust us, those working families, if we're not focused on them as the first words out of our mouth?
Yeah, I agree. What about you, my brilliant college student, Liberty Jones? What's important to you? What do we need to focus on to get youth back in our party? How the hell did this happen that we got them out? Do you have a question for the Admiral?
So I do, you know, like, I think that you bring up a really, really important point when talking about trust deficit, right? And about how we're not taking enough care of the family values that keep the military together. You know, you bring up a fair point that China has a lot more militaristic unity than the United States nowadays. And it's really unfortunate to me that we're not being able to create that space anymore, that we're rejecting the crucial supportive environment to really bringing the trust of this family bond, especially for something like the military. I think it's so important. And even Elon Musk himself, you know, it's kind of individualistic of him to have the power to achieve such great so efficiently and not want to carry that over into the areas that would benefit the American people and military the most. And so my question to you is, how can we rebuild this trust and cohesion? Because I think that is the future. I think reintegrating these moral values, you know, this family-like connection that is so important in achieving these goals and moving towards teamwork and creating a supportive, trust filled environment. How can we go back to building a space like that, you know, where we're including diversity, where we're keeping in mind that all people need to be supported? How do we create that bond so that we can remain strong in all sectors of the United States, but, you know, specifically the military?
It's a wonderful question. And I think I'll answer it for both the military and here in America itself. I honestly believe, and I've said this a lot, it's like the captain getting off of the bridge of the ship and going down and talking to the crew. And I just don't mean into Combat Information Center, which is the brains of the operation, air conditioned, brilliant young men and women in there. They're the fighting the ship. It's where it all happened. I mean going down into the boiler room in the old days and now the engine room today and talking to them and just saying, how's it going down? Up in Pennsylvania, where I was, you could go to 7 states and win the Democratic nomination and the election because there's a majority of Democratic voters in those 7 states. And the other states, not a lot of people go to those things. You got to when I was in Iowa. Man, I'd be going back and forth, shaking hands all the time, running as staff and my volunteers are passing things forward. And one of them ran back, so don't go up that pickup truck. Those guys are going to rip you apart on abortion. They know your position. And I said, okay, well, thanks. Of course, I went off. And then they did. And then I said, okay, let me tell you what I think. Because if you're not talking to them, then it's they versus them. And then us versus them. And I said, look, I'll be honest with you. I'm a Catholic. And I don't know what the right answer is because he hasn't told me. But I'll tell you this. I don't want any government to interfere with such a personal decision. One of them kept yelling, the other guy kind of nodded, saying government interfering. Sometimes you got to talk with them from their aspect and their understanding. And I feel that way. I'll tell you, in the military, I'd had captain's calls, not with the whole ship only. I'd have them with the E1s and E3s, the E4s separately, the E5s, the E6s, and then the chiefs, and then the officers. And then I'd have them all together, and I sliced it and diced it, and then I went to it. I'll tell you, if I'd been president, first thing I would have done the day after being elected, I would have gotten the biggest stadium I could have, the most conservative part of America. And I would have stayed there for a couple hours and answered those questions one-on-one. That's what I did with the Tea Party Patriots. Man, they yell and they scream, but I stayed there 3.5 hours in a couple of those Tea Party town halls until the last one left. And the Delaware County Tea Party Patriots that are represented asked for a photograph. And they didn't vote for me, but the distrust wasn't there. As someone said when I ran for president, a very, very, very conservative county in Pennsylvania, I disagree with Joe Sestak on every issue that he's running on, but I will vote for him if he makes it. Because I trust him. Just like sometimes you may not like how the captain does things, but you trust him to do the right thing for you as them. My proudest achievement in Congress was representing a nearly 2-to-1 Republican district and Republicans versus Democrats. And in that Republican district raised $3.5 million, which is decimal dust today, but back then it was a lot of money for reelection. Didn't spend a penny on a dime. We were everywhere talking with them. And that, to me, is the real key. It doesn't sound very good, very easy, but I got to tell you, that's what George Washington did. He went to all those southern states, feeling very bad, to talk with them about supporting Alexander Hamilton's plan, for having the federal government assume the states. And the South was just like a lot of it is today. They didn't want that government to have more power. But going down and talking with them made a difference in a conversation. Sounds simple, but that's how you learn to trust someone. If you ever want to read a book, read Bowling Alone. Written a decade and a half ago, it began to show how in America, that contrary to the end of World War II, where the women did our factories, Rosie the Riveter and all, and the men went to war, had a common story, and they met and they talked. And whether it was NAACP, the Lions Club, the Kiwanis Clubs, or lunch dinners with your neighbors, which was often about that time, five or six times a month, on average, this book shows you we're now bowling alone. We no longer get together. And the Western Union used to have about 5,000 members in NAACP. It's down to a couple hundred. Or you take a Lions Club, a Kiwanis Club. How many people get together so that you get these conversations alone? Now, I think that's part of the issue, too. Sorry to run on in this one. I really do think it's cultural kind of things we've got to stress a lot of just talking and not having to beat the other guy up as though we're enemies.
Well, you know, I mean, given what you just said, Admiral, we were just, I just pushed very, very hard for a dear friend and associate of mine named Kaylin Free, who would have been the first Native American woman ever to serve in a leadership position at the DNC. She was running for vice chair, and she was the youngest attorney ever in the Justice Department, very well qualified woman, but didn't really finished about the middle of the pack. And it seemed to us during the whole lobbying effort to campaign for her that the fix was in right from the beginning to kind of elect the same old people at the Democratic Party. Do we have too much of that going on? Have we become too incestuous in the Democratic Party? Do we need to branch out more and stop worrying? I don't know. Reconnect ourselves with America. Because I got to tell you, Admiral, the first decent job I ever had, I've been working full time since I was 14 years old, but the first decent job I ever had was as a Teamster. I lied about my age and became a Teamster truck driver when I was 17. And it killed me to see the Teamster, head of the Teamsters Union, at the Republican convention. They've never even attended the Republican convention. And they're the guys giving a keynote speech. I mean, have we just lost touch because we've become too insular?
With I do think so. Look, I've looked, and I was a Navy guy for 31 years, and I'm really just a sailor. When I got in, decided to run to pay back my country because of our daughter's brain cancer that Walter Reed Military Hospital couldn't get in. She said she had 3 months to live. And my wife said, we're going elsewhere. And we went to Children's Hospital and they brought down a wonderful doctor because of our military health care plan, Mass General. And, they gave her back to us. And so my payback to her was really to run for politics. I knew nothing about politics. I didn't even know I'd grown up in a Republican district. I mean, I watched it. I read it. I watched the nexus of policy and politics when I was at the National Security Council with President Clinton, but not politics itself. My payback to her was run for health care. National security begins at home, and health security was my motto. And we won. I took what then later became Romney Care, because Obamacare wasn't around. He wasn't in the presidency, but that was a that was the beginning of it. It was very similar to what finally got passed. That's what I'm running on, put it on my website. I bring that up because then I got, you know, it was so naive. They said, you got to talk to DCCC. I said, the Delaware County Community College? I didn't know what the DCCC was.
That's funny.
Oh, it's true. So, but I watch people, and too many times our politicians are crafting their career instead of mastering their craft. Where they're really not worried so much about their careers and all, and do I take a position here or not? And I watched this, and I could tell you stories of, you know, we went to a caucus with, we were asked to try to save the nation on that great recession, and four people got up and said, don't touch it. They caused this. We don't want. My thing is that we sometimes have people that, in a sense, might be playing it safe. I mean, that's why, as you well know, I was told not to run, even though I was asked twice and then declined it, then accepted it to run against Arlen Specter. And yeah. I stayed in that race and said, I'm sorry, we're no longer in a kingdom here. This is where the people will decide. And that's where I learned it's better to offend God than a politician, because at least God gives forgiveness. And my point of this is sometimes I've watched our candidates on the presidential level be good people, but they're kind of like Snickers bars, you know? They're really a good people, but the packaging is kind of all the same, whether it's 4 years ago or 4 years again. And they're good people, but sometimes I do think that things are how they're expected to be. I mean, as you know, I couldn't really get on the major channels because, you know, it was looked at differently. My God, Abe Lincoln lost, I think it's 7 different types of races out of 9, you know? The only one he won was Congress for one term, and then the next thing you know, he's president after losing a Senate race, a vice president, Texas, etc. But to them, you've got to craft your career or else you're not credible. And so, yeah, I do think in instances that that's what happened with Trump. He really was different. I'm not saying it's good different,
yeah.
But it was different. Right. And I think people are feeling uneasy and untrustworthy. And probably we're running out of time, but if I could give you one story to illustrate this, it's what I used to tell my Republican district all the time. I said, come aboard an aircraft carrier with me. Everybody thinks, well, you get in that plane, you take off, and Walt Disney doesn't have a ride, anything that compares to it. It's the thrill of a lifetime. And that pilot, when they turn on that engine, their feet are, you know, on the brakes, and they've got you locked into a catapult that's going to fling you into the air for that ride of your life. But sometimes something's wrong with that plane. And what they do is said, we got to shut down that plane. I used to tell this, if Paul Hemmer are still listening, he used to tell this in Iowa. And I'd say, hey, before you shut down that plane, though, you got to make sure you're unhooked from that catapult before you shut it off. Because if you're still hooked up, the average age of those 5,000 sailors in that aircraft carrier is 19 and a half. And once in a while, a mistake happens. And if a mistake has happened, you shut off your engines, you're hooked up, and somebody pushes the wrong button, you're going off and you're not coming back. So a young 19 and a half year old youth, as the flight deck freezes, goes underneath the belly of that plane and unhooks you from that catapult. And then he or she walks in front of that plane and looks up at the pilot high above and gives a very simple signal with their hand. And then that youth of America doesn't move until that pilot has opened up their canopy after shutting off their engine and safely on deck. And that youth has said everything this nation most wants and most yearns for. I would tell them, you can trust me because I'm going to stand here in front of that plane. And if I made a mistake and you start heading toward your death, I'm going right through you. You're going right through me. And I'll go overboard with you to my own death. And then I'd pause and I'd say, who do you think might stand in front of that plane for you, America? In Washington, D.C. And it's surprising, nobody ever shouted back to me who. And that's the kind of trust that one learns in the military. And to go back to where you began, Senator, of why you are degrading the dignity of danger that is most precious and is an honor to do in the military by beginning to fire generals and admirals who have served their nation selflessly and politicizing it. But that, to me, to go back to Liberty's question, is the only way to gain the trust, is to be willing to lose it because it's the right thing to do. And I don't think we have that as much as needed.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it really is sad because, you know, I know that military people, as I said earlier, are just, they're noble and they want to stand up for America and we have to stand behind them. I mean, it just seems crazy to me that, these guys, that Elon Musk stands up there with a chainsaw and he's applauded for that, you know, or, you know, I don't know what's happening to America, but it really scares the hell out of me. Let me say, we're running out of time here. I don't know if Liberty has anything to add, but I want to ask you, Admiral, is there something that you want to say that we haven't asked you, that something you want to add?
It's a wonderful question. I have felt, though, for quite a long time, that this intersection that we're having today and over the last decade, perhaps increasingly over the last decade, but definitely in the last few years, the intersection we're having between our economy, such innovative technology, and geostrategy has made almost every issue a national security matter. Whether it's selling chips overseas, whether it's having USAID working in the 12 Pacific Islands, where we used to have military bases during World War II, but China now has gotten about its fourth last week or fifth security agreement with the Cook Islands, as well as four others so far. And as you say, that their USAID is about $40 billion a year, and as General Allen said, who worked with them in Iraq, when they're successful, we won't have a war, or less reason, or less propensity to have a war if they stop a society from exploding. And that's a four-star Marine general. And when you see that their $40 billion is compared to a $1 trillion Belt and Road Initiative that China has employed over the past few years, building the superport in Peru, the only one on the whole of America, except for ours in America, that they can now bypass and get right to South America and unload, and they're building roads for the rich minerals in the Andes. And we're cutting out USAID. And when you see that we need allies and friends, because if we want to stop selling these super chips, we asked the Netherlands and South Korea to hurt themselves and their companies by not selling them to China, and they did it. I can never forget when I was there in the Persian Gulf. I arrived with my battle group in the Indian Ocean for Iraq, Afghanistan. Then we went to Iraq. And when I arrived with 12 United States ships, aircraft carrier submarines, frigates, cruisers, there was a larger armada, almost twice as large, waiting to join us. Japan was there. They had not been outside the sea of Japan since my father had fought against them in the World War II. But they came. The Australians, the New Zealanders, we had the Greeks there. A Polish ship was there. We had them from all over, these 22 ships. And Italy sent one. It was a little bit late. And in his message, Minister Spence said, with a wry sense of humor, many people may think of us Italians as primary lovers. But America has been attacked, and we will be there for them. Every issue is becoming a national security issue, in the sense that we need friends, we need allies, commercially, economically, etc. And to me, that's really why we need more leaders that have global depth of experience and doesn't treat everything like a deal, a business deal.
Well, you know what? I think that's a perfect note to end on. And I would say that I think the most patriotic, if you love soldiers, the best thing you can do for them is to keep them home, right? Right, Admiral? If you love soldiers and sailors and you're a patriot, the best thing you can do for them is to make sure there are no wars. So I think that this is a perfect way to end our show. Liberty, as always, thank you for being on. Admiral Sestak, thank you so much for your service to America, both on the in uniform and in Congress. I don't know which front was more perilous for you, but we appreciate your service. And I'm with Paul. You know, you've got, for what it's worth, Admiral, next time you run for president, you've got at least one vote here and one vote in Iowa. So thanks again for everything you do. And folks, we'll see you next week. And I'll tell you, I'm going to play a song. We always play a song at the end of our show, and we dedicate it to the person that was on the show. And it's so funny, Admiral, you probably won't remember this, but the last time you were on my show, you mentioned this song. You mentioned again tonight, What About Us by Pink. And it really has become an anthem for me, a political anthem, because I believe that this is the one thing that politicians often forget, who they work for. And it really is about the people that elect you. So here's to Admiral Joe Sestak and all the people out there that believe in America, believe in our political system, and want to know what about us. Here's Pink.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.